Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around.
When you speak of Chicago, the corner with our magic, our music, our politics. Fires raised as tribal dancers and war cries broke out on different corners. Power to the people.
Maybe we could start again.
Creating Chicago, welcome back to the Chicago Sunnyside Podcast. Chicago and our many viewers from across the globe. We're your hosts, Kasabaz Makma.
Tizadita Dabasa.
And we're happy to be coming to you with episode 4 of the Chicago Sunnyside Podcast. Today we'll be talking to Kim Delaney from the DuSable Museum. DuSable Black History Museum and Education Center. That's right, right?
Yes.
And she is the Vice President of Education?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Yes, sir.
Okay. We'll confirm with her. Anyway, before we get into that, we just finished the African Festival of the Arts, where we had our Committed Culture Pavilion, as we have for the past few years, the last few festivals. Yeah. Yeah, I think 4. Dead Prez ripped it. They actually, my guy TJ, I was telling y'all about my guy TJ in another episode. He put together, I mean, I'm not really sure the team he was working with, but I know he was the gravitational force around the whole Saturday program centered around. He had 2 awesome panel discussions where he brought together younger artists and older artists from the area. And then he had like a lot of great local acts come out.
Right.
Yeah. So it wasn't just Dead Prez. Dead Prez killed it. Absolutely killed it. New stuff, old stuff.
Missed it. I wish I would
have been over there. You can watch it all,
all right.
On tape. It'll be just like here or there.
Sure. Okay.
But no, I mean, my great camera work, of course.
Right.
Or so everything. No, but Dead Prez killed it. They had Buckshot come out. I hadn't really heard of Buckshot, but he had a nice show. And local artists, Abs 13, Cool Out Chris and Amina. They had some younger talent and that were pretty nice too. Up and coming acts, and they went first, and they had the OGs, the local OGs, mm-hmm. come in. The brother GQ, the teacher, he was hosting, but he came out beatboxing and
nice.
Yeah,
nice.
It was tight. It was a nice show.
Huh?
Fred Hampton Jr., son of the brother Fred Hampton Senior, there. He was out there. He got to speak for a minute. The newer Black Panther revival. I think Prisoners of Conscience Committee. I'm not really sure. I haven't followed as much what he's been doing on the activist tip, but he got to come out and speak. And they had a nice, they had a serious, nice lineup. And Fred Hampton Jr., like Dead Prez album, was how I found out about Fred Hampton and Fred Hampton Jr.
Oh, wow.
And so then, in the song, he's talking about how Fred Hampton Jr. was locked up. Well, now he got out and they're on stage together. It was really a touching moment.
Well, I haven't seen Dead Prez in a long time. I haven't seen Fred Hampton Jr. in a long time. So I guess I missed out.
Yeah.
Vending at the booth like you skipped out on us last year. You skipped out on us this year.
Look,
at least you had a camera.
I had a camera. And hey, I don't want to say too much, but maybe some of these illustrious figures will come on the podcast one of these days. So I'm just gonna be quiet in terms of like details because I don't want to.
Well, make it happen.
Hey, I want it to be a surprise.
Okay, but can I hold you to it?
Don't want to spoil the surprise. Let's not have it. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, we're gonna get to our interview with Dr. Kim Delaney. And before we get to that, we're going to show some clips of these performances some highlights of the performances and highlights from the festival to share with you guys. And because if you didn't make it out to the African Fest, you'll know that you want to make it out next year.
For sure.
So we'll be right back with Dr. Kim Dulaney of the DuSable Black History Museum and Education Center.
Yes.
Man, I'm feeling celebratory, dog.
I be too, man.
You know what I'm saying?
It's time.
Lester. I heard it was going to be like 99 degrees out here.
It feels a little bit like 99, maybe, because
it's solar energy. You know what I'm saying?
It's the people's energy.
Facts. Yo, Flo, what you got, man? Turn the sun on.
Last, look. The fan don't work, but the window will. Boombox props in the window sill.
Young homie on the court with the beatbox skills.
It's all Kimbo gear.
You can tell by the endo smell.
Speedball dreams going to the NFL.
Partners coming home from in them jail.
He's going in the movie.
Drop in movie.
Pop the top.
Way high
to the QT. Ooh,
feels so good in the summer.
Sunshine on your skin. How you doing, pretty woman?
I like to have a good time.
Are you beautiful?
Put your link up. Do something
unusual.
Catch a musical. Maybe some dinner too. Take a ride to the coast.
Enjoy the view.
Pop a bottle.
A little Cabernet.
Every year this time we come like on. To celebrate.
Summertime.
Hey.
Come on. Who knows?
In the city.
Well, welcome. We're here with Dr. Kim Dulaney of currently Education Director of DuSable Black History Museum and Education Center. I got that right, right?
I'm Vice President of Education and Programs.
President of Education and Programs.
At the DuSable Black History Museum and Education Center.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
All right, so you guys get it right. Black History Museum.
Yes.
Black History Museum and Education Center. Now, I think previously it had been referred to as the African American History Museum. And now referred to like Black History Museum. And I noticed that lately you've been going through a rebranding, adding like Education Center to the title. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I am an educator and I came to the South as an educator. And this climate, we wanted to be intentional about our responsibility as an education center. We recognize that he who controls the narratives kind of controlled reality. Mm. And so for me, coming to the museum, we know it's a museum, but I do know also that it is education. Whenever you talk, whenever you create the door, or curate information, it's education. You're doing education. And so we wanted to be intentional about the fact that we acknowledge that responsibility, that we are an education center. As the keepers of and even celebrate the Black history.
Okay. And well, before we get into talking more about DuSable Museum, we'd like to talk more about you and your background. And you said you came to the museum as an educator.
Yes.
Could you tell us about your background in history and the path leading to where you are today?
Yeah. So I've been an educator since I was a little kid. I'm the oldest. I wasn't the oldest child in my household, but I'm my parents' oldest living biological child. Mm-hmm. And so I was charged with the responsibility of educating my younger siblings. Yeah. So my nickname as a kid was Professor. I named me Professor as a kid. And because of that, that wasn't a cool thing for my area. I grew up on the far south side. It was a cool thing to my parents and my aunt, but it was not a cool thing to my kids. Yeah. So because of that, I pushed back against being an educator. I didn't really like
being the smart. But it still was my responsibility. I had to help everybody for Christmas, but I got chalkboards and school supplies.
Wow.
I got some toys, but I never was a person to get dolls and stuff. My little sister, both of them got dolls. I didn't get dolls. I got things that make things, and I got teaching materials,
wow,
which is what I wanted, because that's what had been recognized in me, and that's what was nurtured in me. And then years later, after all my pushing and trying to go elsewhere in other directions, I ended up being a professor. And that happened because I was a writer. I was writing books. And then I was at the Black Women's Expo one year, and somebody came to my booth and told me that they saw my book on the table, and they said, you know, I got to tell you about this book, and I'm about to cry. It's a woman, and she said that she was going to commit suicide. She went to her relative's house as a goodbye, but that was her claim. But she was just one, and she saw my book on the table and read it, and that's why she decided to live.
Whoa.
And when she said that, hold on. I'm just letting some thoughts out, but I recognized the power of the written word. And I'm like, oh, that's the responsibility. I then went and took an African-American studies class because I'm like, I can't just be saying stuff. You know what I'm saying? But even that I think I know, recognizing that I'm young and stuff, I couldn't just be irresponsible. And so I wanted to go get something that could shore up and not be so shallow. So I went and took
it. Hold on, because I didn't know you were a writer.
Yeah.
So you published a book.
Yeah.
At what age?
I started publishing books probably at 33.
Okay.
My first two books was I Love Me, children's book. I Love Me was one, and I Can Fly, the R. Kelly story, was another, because R. Kelly's one of my best friends. And so I had written I Love Me, and I had written this book called Woman to Woman, a selection of essays and poems. And then when I read I Love Me to Rob, when they came to me for lunch, I read I Love Me to him. I said, I'm to him publicist. People were telling me I'm to publicist. Reverend Wright's daughter, Janet, his eldest daughter, Janet, and I were in the same class for years. So she had read it. She shared it with Red, and he's like, oh, you got to publish this. So I'm like, okay, I'm like,
Yes.
And so I went on a lunch outing with Rob one day, picked me up for lunch, and we went to a restaurant. And then while there, I told him I was thinking about doing it. I read I Love Me, and then he's like, oh man, that's awesome. You can do that, can you? Blah, blah, blah. And then I'm like, if I don't want to send to a publisher because it mentions God in it, and I don't want people to change it. I don't want people, and everybody been saying they're going to change it and all that. He's like, publish yourself.
Mm.
That's what Rob said. Publish it yourself. And then I'm like, oh, okay, but then you're going to have all these books, and I had heard all these stories and stuff. Then he said, if you publish, do one about me. Publishing two, that'll get you the media attention.
Mm.
He was right. I did. So my first releases were I Love Me and I Can Fly to R. Kelly Store.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran that one to him. He started crying, like, oh my God, that's perfect, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I got this guy, Sherman Beck, who used to illustrate Anthony Jr. magazine I grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
Got him to illustrate my children's books. All except I Can Fly, this guy around the dean did that. But then I published the books. They got instant attention, bestsellers list through my own publishing company.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, because he was the hot stuff at the time. So he gifted me that. And I had to pay him not one rent cent.
Very nice. Okay, so then moving forward.
Yeah.
Your educational career.
Yeah. So then I went to the take a class in Black Studies. And had Harold Rogers, giant in Black Studies in Chicago. And he was over at Olive Harvey College because I was working out there at the Water Reclamation District. So I went on my lunch and took a Black Studies class.
Wow.
Out there. And then I was so angry behind the plans, plus empowered. But when people first get exposed to the information, first thing you are is angry.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I've been tricked, bamboozled, this kind of deal.
I was there.
Yeah. So I was so bothered. And then Armstead Allen, I took pledge with him over there. And then I decided, I think I was going to finish my degree because I had left. I went to Chicago State University, straight out of high school. But I had left when I got the job at the Water Reclamation District. I had left because I went to work there pretty young. I was maybe 21, got promoted quickly, youngest person, one of the first Blacks in my position there. I was doing that. But when I went back to school, especially too, I was in a work environment, it was majority white, and I got hired. We, all of us Blacks got hired. Because they were sued for not hiring minorities or women.
Uh-huh.
So we didn't place, I placed on the top of the list, but still, that's the climate I went into working in.
Right.
So now I want to take Black Studies classes to shore myself, not lose myself. And then I met Dr. Bartley Wigswamy at Chicago State University. I went over there to Clay, and he became a mentor of mine. He was over the Black Studies program. I didn't really want to go to school per se, but I did want to learn Black Studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to keep taking Black Studies class.
Mm-hmm.
He encouraged me. You just finished your degree. Each point, he tricked me. You know, he's like, you just, you know, you take all these questions to get the degree. I was almost finished anyway, but since I changed majors, I would have to take all these classes. He's like, yeah, just, I got this class coming up. You should take this. Really, it's going to really benefit you, blah, blah, blah. Later, he got me into teaching because when I was really graduating from undergraduate school, he was like, you have a way of communicating that I think really connects with the students.
Right.
You should tutor. that could be your give back. I had money and stuff, so it wasn't about the money for me, so I did that as my give back for Bart Tobinton. Then MFA program, Hakee was over there, and Hakee Manabuti, Professor Manabuti was over there.
Mm-hmm.
Bart, like, oh, yeah, so we write to you, so go over there. It's quick. We get your MFA. It's a terminal degree. You can teach with that. I'm like, I don't want to teach you. Like, but someday, if you want to teach, you can use that. Whatever.
Sure.
Along the way, he got me. And then I ended up getting that MFA, teaching English at Chicago State at first. I taught English. And then later, when Dr. McSwine retired, then myself and another person took his place, took two of us killer shoes. They hired two people when he retired in Black Studies and African American Studies. And that's how I ended up a professor.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I got my doctorate in education. My bachelor's in African American Studies. My master's, I got a master's of fine art and creative writing because I had already wrote the books before I went back to school.
Right.
But it just seemed like a logical thing to do. So I did that, and then I got my doctorate in education.
Okay.
Now, do you ever find that what you may have learned in university through your educational experiences maybe is contrary to what you may see through your other type of education, maybe your studies or your travels, say even to many times to Africa. I know you travel there often, and just wanted to know if you find it.
See, I find any contradictions. Absolutely, all the time. It's full of contradictions. So that's why I'm glad I went into African American Studies, because otherwise I wouldn't have stayed, because it was full of contradiction. Mm-hmm. But Dr. McSwine taught me that he was showing me where, I don't know if it was Malefe Asante or if it was Naeem Akbar, but I do remember him showing me the quote where they said how they take two sets of notes, like one set of notes to pass the class. And it might have been Du Bois even, but one set of notes to pass the class, and the other set of notes is for real learning, right?
Cool.
And so once Dr. McSwine helped me kind of understand that, then I viewed structured education systems differently. Like I said, I never had challenges with understanding material, but the contradictions is what I had, what made me leave in the first place. Because I was like, that's not true. This is terrible. This is against myself. Why it's still being educated against myself. But once I'm made aware of the value of what we call the ticket to get in the room. I just needed a ticket to be in rooms. And so that's how I began to think of the education system. But then that's when I began to benefit from it.
Okay. You know, that's where I see a lot of people having that conflict they'll get to a certain level and then they want to leave because it's a conflict.
Absolutely.
What they're studying, what they're learning conflicts with what they're being taught through the university. And even I even see our children struggling with those things.
Absolutely.
In order for me to pass this test, I need to say X, Y, and Z.
Right.
However, in my own studies, in my own understanding, it's something different than that. And so I think most people have that challenge. And I was wondering how you were able to navigate that.
How I navigated is about my old editor used to call me bottom line. I think of myself as a core concept person. That's who I am. That's my gift. I see straight through everything and see the core concept. So the minutia of sorted facts doesn't affect me because I see the core concept, right? So once you ground yourself, and this was the fact of mathematical studies. Once Naeem Akbar said that education begins with knowledge itself. So once I understand me and myself, then you can toss anything at me. And it's through that lens that I see that information, right? So I understand, once I understood that I don't have to, same thing I teach my students, like you don't have to take every aspect of this information and concrete and absolute, right? This is an interpretation. This is one person's perspective and their interpretation, right? Mm-hmm. So what are the core concepts that we can take out of that, right? So especially teaching African-American studies, teaching African-American studies, I can look at, like for instance, my students might say, well, when they haven't been exposed to any concept of anything African, they might ask, oh yeah, well they get prior crisis or they CLA people or they say wives, they daughters, or their religion has multiple gods. Well, that's so beautiful to me to have the opportunity to help them see four concepts, right? Mm-hmm. So I could say, look at Catholicism, right? Where you have a supreme God in that structure, right? Mm-hmm. Then you have saints. There's still hierarchical structures in that structure, right? Mm-hmm. It's the hierarchical levels. And most, for most religions, you find the same structure, the same core concepts. Most religions, right? The core concepts are similar. And then when I talk about systems of governance, I talk about, like from writing this book now, and I talk about mentioning it, when you look at the principles of mind and then the Ten Commandments, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm like, you follow the Ten Commandments, right? It's a system of governance, right? And then I show them what's lost in translation and minutia, right? So what's basically minutia? So you get the principles of Ma'at, and then Ma'at says one major difference that seems small is Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not this and that, right? Thou shalt not this, thou shalt not. Well, that's external governance. An African-centered understanding, I have internal governance. So when I look at the principles of Ma'at, I say, I have not this, I have not that. That says small, but then it's different. That's the difference, right? So once I show them how people understand information and why, what are the anchoring systems that make them understand information in that way, once we explore those things, then people are more understanding. When we talk about variety price, we're in class with college students or older people too, if it's the naming class. They're like, yeah, I'm saying, and I'm like, if you think about it, how many people were here dating people that didn't pan out to be who they thought they were? All I had to learn. Yeah. Wouldn't you have liked somebody to vet that person? Right. Wouldn't you have allowed for a whole family to stand behind what and make that person responsible?
And that's the thing that is so missing from, like, what you're talking about, these core concepts and being able to decipher, like, the underlying, even code, we can say. Because us today, we can say we went and we saw the divine code of human behavior. Like, well, where did this come from? First time I've ever seen this. I'm interested in to just find out, to understand more about this ideology in and of itself. And then we can break that down further and say, because as you were talking about the 44 laws of Ma'at, mm-hmm. how this particular doctrine says, I have not this, I have not that, it's even derived from that code of human behavior, because those codes say thou shalt not, thou shalt not, whereas those were confessionals where people were saying, I have not done this. So in traditional culture, like before you transition, you list what you have not done. You list, I have not done this, I have not done that.
That's right.
So that goes in your grave with you.
Absolutely.
And so when the grave robbers came and uprooted all of that, now they're just reading someone's confessional. This wasn't the confessional. This wasn't the entire divine ordinance. And that's the difference. And even the Ten Commandments are coming from this longer list of ordinances.
That's right.
And
The four principles come from a longer list.
Yes.
But I think that's what's important to me. It's like lost in translation. So if you read that thou shalt not, and you don't have any sense of understanding about the history of that, the historical context of that, then that's what you think. So thou shalt not becomes, if you didn't see me, I'm not really accountable. Right? I'm not really accountable. And that's why we have like a system like an American governance where you have the most laws and the most crime.
Right.
If it's not,
because it's only just human beings who who have to prove that you did something. As long as you can trick whoever you try to trick or bully whoever you try to bully, you can get away with whatever you want.
But absolutely.
If you understand that your laws are coming from something higher that's unseen, that's with you, or that
with you.
Yeah, that's with you anytime.
Major.
Yeah.
That's a major difference. If I understand that God is in me, right? And with me. Well, I can't get away from myself, and I can't, everything I do is seen and known, then it's like psychotic trickery if I'm trying to play with myself. And it's not about human beings, like whatever you could see or prove. One of my students once was telling a story about how she was from, I don't remember where, she's from the continent, but though, first generation. She was actually born on the continent, but she was at Chicago State studying. I never forget in the class once she was telling the story about, she said something was missing in her village at home. And her grandfather said, it must be some Americans here. That was hilarious to me because she had a grandpa said, it must be somebody visiting, like about Americans here, because they don't steal from each other.
Right.
It's no squeaky. No, not the sleepy, because you know it's sane. So you don't even toy with that concept, right? But if my governance is all outside of me and through your healing interpretation, then I'm liable to do anything. I need a rule for everything, right?
And that's what we call like the code of a society of laws versus a society of principles.
Absolutely.
When you're living by a society of laws, then yes, you need the police. And that's our governing court. And that's why we have so many systems. You have this group of people who are overseeing this group of people, who are watching this group of people, who are watching another group of people. And you have all of this governance lights and forces that are really trying to make people adhere to these simple laws of society. However, if you don't have those principles within you, like you said, anything you do behind closed doors is just...
So recently watching this documentary called BS High, right? Bishop something high, right? Hilarious, because the guy, the football team did all of this here. He did all these things he didn't have any credentials to do. Started a team, had the young people playing, ended up on ESPN playing. And the team, it wasn't even a school.
Wow.
And then I'm watching it, thinking, how if he be an interview? We even in jail, right? Then they say, it's no law. See, that's what I'm saying. That's some error. Like, everything I do, I just do it like, well, no law, obviously. But against that act.
Yes.
Not against the product.
Right.
That I'm lying and cheating. No, it's just that particular thing. So I need a law for everything, and that comes after everything is violation.
Right.
Violate, then recreate.
It's crazy.
Yeah, that's the thing they're talking about now with the AI stuff. It's like they're like, we need to come up with laws governing this so that it doesn't end up get out of hand to the point where like it's too late before the damage is done.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's what happened with me. I went to school, got exposed to Black Studies, and then I found, through Black Studies, I found a place where I felt I fit in academia. My mentor, Dr. McSwain, one night asked me to go to the a Christmas celebration, which was surprising for me, for him. And it was at somebody's house on the southeast side of Chicago. We went, and it was around the back to a bakery party. Went downstairs. They started playing Prince. I saw a lady who was a professor take her outer jacket off and start swinging. They were dancing. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I do show with these people. Going to parties and stuff. Well, okay, I guess they are human. In the other spaces, they seem disconnected. That was a great lesson for me. So that's why I teach my classes just as a real person. I don't pretend to be something else, so that people can find themselves in me, in my ways, and know that you're welcome here.
So we wanted to ask you about education and kind of like reaching, because we have, even in the Black community, kind of a disconnect between like the educated and the uneducated.
Right. Formally educated.
Exactly. Yeah. Formally educated and not formally educated. You could be educated by a school and still be uneducated in many ways, there seems to be a different disconnect between those with the college degrees and those who don't. And having been in the education field myself, teaching after school programs for some years, and I've run across students of many different grade levels who just have difficulty with basic reading skills and things of that nature. And it makes me wonder, like, what kind of future can you have in a society like this? I mean, there was a time in society where you didn't necessarily have to read and write and you'd be able to do all these, pass these standardized tests in order to like have a job where you can use your hands, be a carpenter or whatever, but those times seem to be gone. So how can we reach those communities that are having those kind of standard gaps? I mean, gaps in like the formal education, and how do you see DuSalvo Museum fitting into that?
Well, when I went to teach elementary school, I went for that reason, because my son, he's now 33, but at the time, my son, I had watched students who went to school, young men who went to school with my son, who were considered advanced, and then went to Chicago public school to end up dropouts in high school, early in high school. Like, and I'm like, I know that, and they can't keep up to the coursework. So this deal was brilliant as a small kid. So I wanted to study that firsthand. So I went to teach in St. Sabina, and I taught over there. My player and asked me to come over there. I went over there and taught. Fifth grade, I had class at first, but then I had third through eighth, and I taught academic study, and it answered my questions for me. One time this young fella came, he used to always get in trouble, and they would send him to my class. He comes to my class and said, I told him, I come upstairs, he's waiting outside my door. I'm like, what are you doing? You're in trouble, man. What's going on? He said, I think you just be wanting to talk here and spend time with me. He said, well, I do. Then he said to me, he's helped me in my class, and he said to me, they don't like me here.
Really?
I'm like, that's not true. Why you say that? Like, don't, we shouldn't say that. I said, do you think that's real? We really feel that way? He said, oh, they don't like me. Nothing I do is right. The way I look, where I wear my clothes, where I talk, that's all they do all day long is criticize me. Yeah. I don't like them, so they don't like me.
Yeah.
I was about to cry, but I just kept working so he could keep talking. And then he said, that's why he lived around 79th Street. Yeah. He said, the guys around here, they like me. They laugh at my jokes. They come to my gang. Come to the gang members, he told me. They laugh at my jokes. They come to my games. He's like, they like me. The people at this school don't like me. I'd rather be with them. Yeah. That's what he said. And I'm thinking, that's it. It's the push factor. We push people out of school, right? It's not intelligence. It's a push factor where you feel unwanted. You feel disrespected. When I tell you that you're like, stop talking like that, then I'm criticizing your mama, your grandmama, and everything you love, because everybody you know talk like that.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of explaining that this is the language of this space, just like if you were in
China and you would speak their language. This right. is the language for this academic space, but right. that, but your language is not wrong because the purpose of language is communication. Mm-hmm. So if I mumble and you get it,
it's good.
It worked.
Right.
Right? And so I think that those fundamental grounding things of where people felt isolated and disrespected is what mainly drove into teaching, right? Because I come from a particular population. I wanted to represent that population. And I wanted to represent to that population that you deserve this too. We don't have to abandon structured education completely because these people who are often low self-esteem, broken little people are mimicking others. It's a way for you to exercise brilliance, understand study, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you said, the time of not reading or writing is gone. It's gone, no matter how brilliant you are. The systems that we have to engage in order for our people to be safe and whole in these environments mean some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we have to engage it. Now we have to figure out a way, as you used a word earlier, to navigate. So how are we going to do that? That's what I'm here to show.
Yes,
I'm here to show people how to know what happened. Yeah. You need access, and to get access, you need tools.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have to do is what we've had to do. It remains the same, right? We have to be clear on who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can go into the, and why we're going here to go get what we need to get so that we can fully be who we, as a collective, who we were meant to be.
Okay.
But I think there's a huge disconnect there, even what you're saying about knowing who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Most people, even educated people, don't know who we are right. because we've been miseducated so terribly.
Absolutely.
And it's like, even that is a disconnect because if we're talking about the quote unquote uneducated, oftentimes you'll see bills that's where the brilliance is. The mm-hmm. ones that are considered uneducated because they formerly educated because they know that the system is against them. They know that there is corruption here. They know that this is not something that's designed for my success. So they rebel against that. So at the age of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, they are still pleasing and happy to learn and to study. When they get to a certain age and they see that disconnect,
ooh.
They start to push back as well.
Yeah.
And it's like, we can't reach them because we can't trick them.
Yeah.
Now, as long as you can
treat
people,
yeah.
then you can get them to continue to accept the system.
Friend, go and teach now. Let me say this, though. We have to be careful to say formally educated in these structures.
Sure.
If I, from my African set and understanding, I know what education is, right? So it does it some way, like me memorizing your information. That's not right. That's not what it is. So we say formally educated in these systems, right? That's one thing. The other thing is, though, I would push back and say that wherever my people are, that's what I need to be. Period.
Exactly.
Period. So if then that became the problem with Black people. So during the Black Power Movement, late 60s, early 70s, that was the greatest academic achievement for Black people in this city,
mm-hmm.
right? And possibly in this country. I've read different things, but definitely in this city, right? Why? Because people learn about themselves. Right? So if I can teach you about yourself, I spark your love for you and for knowledge acquisition. I make you love learning, right? How do I do that? So I wouldn't say that I'm careful to make sure when I talk about structured education systems and my role in them that it's a reclamation because we come from excellence in academic. Understand we were the leaders of this stuff, right? So for me to engage in it now, it's not me engaging in their bamboozlement. It's me going into a war to fight for the reclamation of who I am, what I come from. You get it? This is a reclamation. So
if we look at, I always tell, when I tell people like in ancient Kemet, right, when you talk about the center of higher education, all of the people, white people, Eurocentric people who want to impress people, saying they study their family.
Gee.
Right? That's like people say they study in Harvard today. Back then they said they studied in Kemet.
Right.
They went, so if that's a belong to other people, it belongs to, it's in our heritage. And just like I wouldn't let people have anything, we can't pick and choose. So say, I talked to some activists and they were like, well, about different things.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, male friends of mine had said, oh, did they break up with the lady? She acted crazy. So I just had to tell my kids when they're older, but I'm not going to deal with that. Oh, but if she took your Bentley, would you go get it? Would you just let her ride?
Yes.
Or would you go over there and say, no, that's not going to happen? If with a material possession in this material world, you would go get it. Well, this is your blood. You have to have that same commitment. So the right to knowledge is my birthright. And it's in my legacy. And I'm going to use every space I go into to help heal what you're talking about. I understand that the average person in there don't understand who they are. But that's my role. I'm not going to say, well, I ain't going to engage in it and go over in the corner while all of my people are over there. No, I'm going to go over in the corner, shore up myself, build my army to go into those spaces where my people are and equip them with the tools they need for this war.
And that's where it's like, well, how do we even reach the ones who have been left behind, who are really very intelligent, but because they don't fit into a particular box or paradigm that this society has shaped for them,
right?
Then it's like, that's what I think the original question is.
They locked
like,
out. They locked out of the system, and they locked out of access to resources. They
absolutely
locked out of access to information.
Yeah,
information sources. So they might have like the common sense understanding of things, but when it comes to information of like knowledge itself, like you're talking about, a lot of that may be contained in books. A lot of that may be dealing with organizations you may have to join or study with, like the Earth Center. But it like becomes very difficult to access when you're kind of locked in a certain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically, your block, your neighborhood.
Absolutely. So what are the tools that we've discovered to work with that? So again, I say, it's only so much you could do from outside on the perimeter, right? So some of us who have the opportunity and the courage and the wherewithal, the fight. I went back to school as a big grown maidhood lady.
Did you?
I had the fight in me. When I went back to school, I wasn't like a naive young person. I had already achieved a level of success from my community outside of academia.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went back to academia. So I move in academia in a different way. So I think it's very important for us to find people, first of all, that we consider comrades within systems.
Mm-hmm.
And then work with those people. Now, what happens is we are trained to isolate. So in every structured system, there are people like, oh, I don't mess with that because it's tainted. So if you're in that, you're tainted too, right? Mm-hmm. For education. When I first went back to school, people were like, we're going to go back. It's the great people there. I don't care what all the people are there. Mm-hmm. I don't care about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care about that. Now, I do care if you're not going to help me fight. That's a problem. And that's what we find. The police system, right? Okay, we know the police system is corrupt.
Right.
Well, I also know that the police system started $70,000, and I know people can't feed their families.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that you are in control of what you do when you arrive at a scene.
Right.
That's
a police officer, yeah.
I know that when I grew up, the guy that was my boyfriend as a teenager led the local gang. Him and his brother went on the police force later.
Wow.
He retired recently, right? He took his money that he got was able to help the community. Yeah. That he went and got from the police system. I mean, we and structures. And there's no way for us to, this is a capitalistic country. If your child is hungry, there's no way for you to. You can't talk about
college itself when you're starving.
And guess what else? Nobody's going to follow you if they think it's going to lead to their demise.
Yeah.
It's a fact, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people want to know what they do. When you get the information, you see people light up. People want to know. But you have to attach it to the reality of your circumstances, right? So it's like I could talk all day to I'm blue in the face to people who are starving. And then I don't have not one thing to say about how they're going to eat. It's not a good plan of mine. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so I think that, and again, I don't look for people who think exactly like I think. I look for people that I could find common ground with, that I could do work with to help our people. That's what I do. What I know is there is no duplicate me out there. I don't even match myself on some days. So I'm looking for people who have core concepts that govern their lives that align with the way I govern my life or the way I understand and my goals for first and foremost my people and then humanity as a whole. That's what I look for. That's who I pull into the spaces I'm in. Most people, when I was at Chicago State, I'm retired now, but when I was at Chicago State at DuSabo, I do this thing called Pass the Mic, where organizations, activists, grassroots organizations that I know exist, they're meeting in dirty, dingy basements.
Mm-hmm.
They have to meet where they can meet.
Right.
Why? No. My tax money adds on to the to Chicago State.
Yeah.
I'm here now. Everybody's here now.
Mm-hmm.
Come have their meeting here in this clean space. It affects the way you feel entitled to things in life. Come have your meeting here, right? What are the resources here? There's a legit, serious way to attend to. These are the resources for the people.
Yeah.
And we're going to give them to the people.
Well,
so I've been in all these rooms. I know you can't get none of that if nobody's in the room. And if somebody's in the room, like myself, it's a daily fight. It's a fight every day. So we have to get the community to fight too. We don't just say, oh, I'm not going to touch it. Can you imagine it's a big bushel of food over there and we're starving to death? We just say, oh, I'm not for, we're not even going to go get things for it.
Right.
We're like, it's not going to touch it because it's there. No. I mean, we all going to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're going to figure out how to eat for ourselves so we don't have to go fight be feet for this food. But until we do, it's our right to eat.
Well, this concept of building bridges like with like-minded people, that's what the Chicago Sunnyside podcast is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope you'll be following us as we go because we'll be talking to a lot of community people who are doing big things such as yourself.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to talk with you a bit about your relationship with Dr. Burrow.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Burroughs, I didn't have a real personal relationship with. Dr. Burroughs was my mentor. Archie Lisenby was a guy in the art world. When I bought my first home, Archie Lisenby was providing art for women that I knew that were doing maintenance women for that day. And he provided art for my home. Dr. Burroughs was his mentor. That's how I first met her and came across her. He had the downstairs gallery in the garage over there at her house in the back. Right. And he had all this great art from Africa, dipped all over Africa that he sold. I later started selling art to the athletes and entertainers through Archie. And Dr. Burroughs, that's where the influence came because he was her mentor in the art world.
Okay.
I mean, she was his mentor in the art world. He was my mentor in the art world. The other was through Hatib Madhubuti, who was my professor.
Okay.
She was a mentor of his. So I've encountered her a couple of times at Chicago State for sure. And then when I was at St. Sabina, Father Flager, who does a great job of bringing people in over there to speak, he told me one day, come bring Dr. Burroughs over here. What you think? Good. We brought her in. She talked to the students from a Black Studies perspective, which was the fact that I was teaching. She talked to the students, and then she later went back to a class with me.
Really?
And she didn't have to. Her time was up, but she wanted to stay with the kids. She stayed all afternoon, talked to them about poetry, listened to their poetry. she was hugging him. And that's when I wrote a poem for her called A Peculiar Flower, because that's when I really got to firsthand see and know her personality. Was through that person who gave me that St. Sabina. But I had encountered her on several times in other spaces. Yeah.
Okay. And could you speak any more to her legacy and, you know,
yeah.
I'm sure we can't do justice to her legacy here in this few minutes, but.
So what I know is that she was a woman of the people. That's what I'm most excited about.
By the way, we have her up here.
Okay. Yes. No. I'm most excited about working in that legacy because she was a woman of the people. Later, you think you really do embrace stuff. Me, I'm like, I went to Cook County. I want to teach some classes in there. I'm going to in the Division 9 and landing where murderers are, the divisions that's getting no attention. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go in there and teach. And then I'm thinking I'm doing something. People like Margaret did that. Dr. Burroughs did that. She did it for years consistently. Mm-hmm. We just met last year. A guy who came earlier this year, guy who came to DuSabo for another program, he got to speak, and he had been incarcerated years ago, and he talked about that's what started his writing career, her, wow. And how he loved her so. So he was emotional, moved to tears for being in the space that he knows she started because how she changed his life coming to the prison and teaching them writing. So Dr. Burroughs, from the mentors, talking about her sliding them money, an artist, when she knew what that life was like and that it was a starving artist was a real thing, she was slipped in money from her fighting for, again, people outside of the structured education system, fighting for them to have access to information, right, and to systems and to learning and things. That was who she was. That's what she did. That's the legacy of DuSabo that it started from the bottom, as opposed to a bunch of people getting together just thinking, well, this is what these black people deserve. Mm-hmm. It was born out of her, remember that whole knowledge of self, her going to Africa herself, bringing back the items, people loving it and being interested in those items in her home, her talking about it, and then her saying, oh, you know what? We need a space where we can showcase our art and our culture, right, for everybody. And it needs to be a decent space, not just a basement or a house. Mm-hmm. It needs to be a museum.
Mm-hmm.
And so she, what we've done, that's what I'm talking about. She was an educator. She's an activist. She's an artist. She's all of these things. But she didn't say, oh, well, they didn't do that. No, she said, I'm entitled to all of these things as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm my people. So if we don't have it, I'm going to create one. Right? And so with DuSabo is now part of museums and a part of a group of 11 museums. We're in the same museum. Right now, I'm the chair of the education committee, which is all the directors from the education systems from all of these 11 museums, the Adler, the Shed, the Field Museum, the Museum of Science and Industry. All of these, it's 11 of us that sit on Park District property. Yeah. That we work as a collective, right? Well, I'm currently the chair of the education committee, which is made up of education teams from all of those museums. That exists because Dr. Burroughs knew we were entitled to it.
Yeah.
And got the building, got the space through those. She couldn't have did that as an outsider completely, right? So she was on the part of this work. She went into these systems and got something for her people.
Yeah.
I love it. I always say, that's the job. You got to go in and get something.
Well, so, sorry, you have some?
No, I'm going to the notion of art and what is art, what is, we oftentimes see things stated as art, and sometimes they're like spiritual items, items that people will say, we went to Africa and we got this and we got that, and they bring these things back. Mm-hmm. And sometimes these things are very powerful and they don't even know what they are. And I also recognize, did these people give these things freely, or did they get them taken away from them? And it's like, when do we return those things? Because mm-hmm. we see museums
yeah.
with so many of our things. And it's like, that's the question. Or
sometimes it's dead bodies.
Yeah, amen. Well, I could tell everybody, rest assured that Dr. Brown didn't steal one. Not her.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the other museums, it's coming out now, though. I love it. It's all over. Where people are like, where did it get from? That whole reclamation thing is strong. For me, that's a tough topic. Like some people say, well, you should just give it back. All the time, they are giving it back, and it doesn't benefit those people. Still, because of these systems. These systems are harsh and have paid years to create strong foundations.
Right.
So I think sometimes, like I was reading one, I think last year, they recovered something. And they were saying, so you get the money, you get the piece back, we've worked such and such, and this other place has made such and such off of it. And I was thinking, in a land of starving people, where that piece of art for you all is a part of your culture. I might disagree with like, oh, just take that because now it comes from the white thing, it's special. You did take it, it was special. Mm-hmm. But it also now finds something. It should, the value of it should be retired. But it also now might fund something that could help propel us to a stronger position. I know a lot of people don't agree with that. I get it. But it depends too on who's running these systems, right? Who's running even the government in different parts of Africa. All of those things. Clearly it should be returned. That's a fact. But the value of it, what happens with it, that should be discussed on a case by case basis to me.
Yeah, that's the part where even we could even go into reparation different things like that. Like, do you take money for that, or do you just return those things? Because it's like, how can we put a value on it?
That's what I'm saying.
They don't have money, and should we return it? Doesn't belong to them.
That's right. Yes.
And the same with us. We will go and we will like fight for reparation, but it's like, can you even repay for all the crime, all the loss that has been taken place since slavery, colonization, all these things.
Well, that's another topic.
I mean, it's another topic.
And I want to frame that topic. I want to talk about it, but I want to frame it because it's really another question that we have. You are with DuSable Black History Museum.
Mm-hmm.
You have other museums, like the one in D.C. that's kind of recent, that's like African-American museum, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the difference between it being Black and African-American is Black makes it global. It's about Black culture globally.
Right.
And so that puts it very different than just being African-American.
Mm-hmm.
Now, recently you have a movement called ADOS, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but for our listeners, American Descendants of Slavery.
Yeah.
Which totally removes any reference to Africa or Black from the title of people who's like Black people.
Mm-hmm.
On the surface of it, it's like you're trying to fight for reparations and saying this shouldn't be for us and not for people who didn't go through this experience with our ancestors.
Yes.
But you also have kind of it becoming a way to identify yourself as like separate from these other Black people across the world. So I wanted to see if you could speak to that concept of our kind of the disconnect between our people here and our people across the globe.
Yeah. So I don't think there's a good answer because I know scholars, and this has been a scholarly debate, especially it's also a generational debate, like mm-hmm. what elders are more apt to align with Pan-Africanism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wherever we find people of African descent and where younger folks are saying, nah, this is my suffering here.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could say to it, there's no good answer for it, but I do understand it. I understand mm-hmm. it. I do understand that they don't understand that it's short-sighted.
Mm-hmm.
But I do understand where it comes from. It is short-sighted. It's like starting over. It comes out of not being aware of the fullness of the experience. It also comes out of people from the continent now, then again, African American always being on the bottom, always on the bottom. Mm-hmm. So young people just not with it. They're not with it. And I understand where it comes from. Again, I say it is short sighted because they don't know the big picture. So if I could turn you inward to fight all your own self, right, it weakens us, but they don't get that because all they know is every time we talk about a collective, they're at the bottom.
Really?
So for them, they're saying, don't match me up with nobody. If we look at in higher education, when they oftentimes award scholarships or when they say, oh, we got people, African Americans on the faculty, it's not African Americans, it's from America. Is continental Africans, yeah, right? So again, they people don't realize it's all our fight, even those people trained in that way. So if you go into academia and you study in England or London, now you study in London and all this here, and you have a Eurocentric performance in your understanding of self, and then that is purported as a representation of African American, that's what the push is about. The push
or
is
even
about
that representation of African, because
not right.
Not we were just talking about, we were just talking to Baba Singbe, Patrick Woodser of African International.
They're not their friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about when he came over here, the white man education did a number on him, and it really took his wife to help him turn
absolutely
around and see the value of where he's coming from.
Yes.
So we have the problem on both sides of people being conditioned a certain way. But the thing is, we all kind of together in our suffering. Like, while people was being taken from Africa and brought over here, these people left in Africa who were suffering.
Absolutely.
So, but to say that our experience over here is what shapes our whole reality is to kind of almost be like, now I'll put it this way. Nobody who was taken and captured and put on a slave ship was sold a ticket to go to the promised land, to a new world where land of milk and honey, like they did in Europe at the same time.
Right.
They didn't want to leave. But yet now, fast forward 400 years later, 200, 300, 400 years later, for depending on when it happened to our ancestors individually, now we aren't trying to go back. We over here are trying to go back to Africa where our ancestors didn't want to leave from. We're not trying to go back and reconnect from whatever that was over there, and saying that now we have a unique identity that's based in the struggle here is almost to be like, okay, well, the one who put our ancestors in slavery is the ones who's defining our reality of who we are now.
That's right. I think trauma is real.
Yeah.
It is. Right now, there is a place for people going like that. But since they had the year return in Ghana, you've had all of these people who brought up myself. I don't know. It's interesting for me because I went to Ghana before the year return. And so I am watching a change in across the continent of Africa, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're still ideologically where we haven't done the work. Mm. So you can't just take a body, right, and a dream, and then say, go put it in Africa.
Right.
And then, okay, now,
and then you,
now
you
repair.
Functioning
that's
the
not going to repair.
Right.
So that's right. And so we have to be careful of that. That's like a fantastical thing. Like, people like, oh, go retire. I'm retired. I'm going to kill people and do whatever else we've been trained to do.
And I have a sister on the ground over there who's telling me these type of situations where she has her young children over there. She's got a daughter in her early 20s and a couple sons in their teens. And her daughters had some bad situations just on the social scene dealing with other African-Americans over there.
Absolutely.
So it's...
Listen, we have to do the work of healing.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do the work of healing. And then we are... ultimately, so there's so many, it's so layered. The conversation is so layered because on one hand, you could be like, well, that's not your whole world. But for some people, if you're trapped in an urban hood. Yeah. And no, you never even been downtown.
Right.
This is your whole knowledge base. Uh-huh. This corner. This block.
But it's then to become that, to become the source of pride and yeah. say, this is the end goal for me.
Right.
That's where I see the problem. Like, okay, if our reality is here, because uh-huh. this is where we've been.
Yeah.
But to dissociate ourselves from something else is problematic, because then you're reducing the size of your world and your opportunities and possibilities. Because like you're saying, there's a lot in African culture. The principles, I mean, to go back to our conversation earlier about having the internal mold to, for being a good person, for yeah. being a decent human being, and where those principles come from, that comes from our people. That's a source of yeah. pride that we Absolutely. Can tap into in our that where, how we access that, if automatic you said, oh, it's from Africa, that's not for me. I'm not with that.
Well, I think that the one method is to, way that I try to deal with that trauma, because mm-hmm. it is trauma.
Yes.
One way that I try to deal with the trauma on others and on myself that has worked on me is that, first of all, I make people understand that I'm talking about traditional African culture, because
mm-hmm.
Africa has been colonized, and so people... Students are very resourceful, and they'll be like, look what's happening there, or look what they're doing there,
right.
look at this government.
Right.
So there's nothing sexy about going to that,
mm-hmm.
because that's worse than what I know this beast,
right.
and that's how they feel.
Right.
But I have to make people understand that it's all traumatic.
Right.
And so what we're trying to do is look beyond, way back before that, to the core concepts.
Mm-hmm.
How do we find that? Like when people say something is African, I've been asked many times, like, well, how can you say it's African? So the approach that we take in studying it in African American studies, we look for concepts, practices, traditions across varied groups, ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then if that's something that we find is consistent, then that's African. So we know the manifestations are different for different mm-hmm. groups. And then surely after colonization, that's infected as well. So,
let me give you an anecdote, because remember I came in with Nahez to the museum, I think on Juneteenth, and you yeah. showed us around, and you had someone who just started, and you would ask her, does she want something to eat? It was her first day, and she was okay. like being referred to you, and you just introduced her. Mm-hmm. She was just introduced to her, and the first thing you asked her, well, do you want something to eat? She was like, no. And then we start to keep going. Then you turn around and ask us, like, do you guys want something to eat?
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, no, we're good. And I know that you know that we're going to say no. But the fact that you ask, just the courtesy like that you offer, and that's totally African. That's something that we do over there. Mm-hmm. And you ask someone if they want to eat, like you could be at a restaurant, someone passes by and greets you, and they say bon appetit, and you say amite, you're invited, dude. Come take some. You know they're not gonna like sit at your table,
yeah, well, okay.
take you up on that, but it's the courtesy.
Yeah. So listen, when students generally first
come, and I was wondering where you were going with that. I was just like,
I'll say it because
I get it now, yeah, but I'm like,
yeah, these times.
So all of these, what we call Africanisms, these retention,
right?
So now, even in the field of psychology, they talk about your body having retentions, right?
Mm.
So there are traumas real in your body. There's one called my grandmother's thing. Yeah, I'm listening to that. So the trauma is really in your body, but retention is as well, right? These retentions that are passed on sometimes. So sometimes I think, again, when students first come to my class, they say it's no such thing as African American culture. We don't have a culture. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Right? That's not real. We do have a culture. But what my job is, for, like I said, myself, nobody's going to attach to nothing that they can't relate to.
Right.
That's authentic.
Right.
So my job for myself was to first study and see if there are any commonalities where I find myself in this African, in these African cultures, right? Mm-hmm. In this broad culture. Now, depending on different groups, they've got different ways of doing things. But if I look at the core concept, then I can see. So we have baby showers.
Right.
Straight up African, right? Mm-hmm. We have it made American, right? I could say our understanding of time, right? Yeah. And it's cracked me up because people be like, they don't see big time or it's back. Well, it's a proper time. It's not on Eurocentric time.
Right.
It's on time.
Right.
It's on time.
Natural time.
It's on natural time. So we have to, I meant to talk about a Sintepi time, right? So we have to, if I'm saying that right, but we have to broaden ourselves to these core concepts. And then once we understand the core concepts, we see how that impacts our other understandings, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how, when I'm talking about things, so I'm talking about hospitality, communal care.
Uh-huh.
You had the baby, so I'm going to do this for you. We'll do that right now. We help it because we're a communal people. Mm-hmm. So in my class, what I don't do, it's just like I won't do the religion. I'm not going to
buy them.
A piece of a sentence somebody picks out. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make sense. What is the essence of the thing? So in my classes, when introduction after American Studies class, when you leave that class, you're going to understand that communal method is the core concept for African culture, mm-hmm. period. I don't care if you see people being thirsty and stealing from each other today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying the core concept of African culture is communalism, and that was across cultures, right? I can explain it. I had a white teacher teach me that in my critical thinking class, not that about communalism, but about why Europe was different with the weather change, with limited cane space, with all of these things about how you survive that would affect how you communicate with somebody because it's about survival.
Right.
In a country where I need you to survive and where you live it in the open, it makes sense that we would be communal,
mm-hmm.
right? That I would need to work with you because now the river gonna rise or whatever's going to happen, we're going to have to move over, get food over there. We do that better together, right? So communalism, so much so that my final exam in my class would be communal. And all y'all going to get the same grade. So now throughout the class, I've had different people study different things. They've also presented it. The group is only going to be as good as each individual in the group. So if somebody, I got a question on this fight, I don't tell them that in advance. I just say, be sure to master your area. Fully understand your area, right? And then on the exam, they're talking to each other. I'm listening to music, usually, just making sure they don't end up in a fight.
Right.
Other people fear it's about their grade.
Right.
And then they'll hear them discussing it.
Yeah.
The person, I say it in advance, then it's going to teach you about society. Because the person who speaks the loudest isn't necessarily the most knowledgeable. The person who has the best diction isn't necessarily the smartest. You have to tap into the intelligence of everybody in the group in order to be successful because everybody has a different knowledge set. I did that on purpose. Like, and we understand everybody has a different gift.
Right.
So, and then the test is familiar, whatever the grade is, everybody in their class is in the grade that they are failure. I'm going to fail again. So you have to encourage. They don't know that till they walk for the tennis. They've all studied part and everything. So I know my work is done with that really.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how are you going to make each other show up? How are you going to encourage, like if you're quiet and you're not talking much, how am I going to help nurture out of you your strength so we can pass this test? I have to help other people to calm down some so you can have a moment. You know what I'm saying? It works.
Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street.
If you don't know by now, talking about shy